Thank you very much. Welcome again to the land of phrase and fable, where the only unforgiven sin is an unintentional pun, a sin, I might say, never committed by our resident fablers and phrasers, Frank Muir, Dilys Powell, Antonia Fraser, and Dennis Norton. And we start today with bibliophily. How's about that for a word, Frank?
Difficult to start with, isn't it?
Pretty difficult to start with. You are something of a bibliophile. So what is the significance to you...
No problem.
...of cottage, fanfare, macabre, and little Gidding?
I know a little about little Gidding, not very much, but it comes in T.S. Eliot, twice, I think, and it's a little village in Cambridgeshire... with a reputation for being very holy.
Do they send a tingle running up your spine? That's the key question to ask yourself.
No. T.S. Bindings.
Somebody in the audience knows and said almost simultaneously...
Cottage binding. Yes, there's cottage binding. That's the
cottage
only one
binding,
I've heard of.
Fanfare binding, macabre, little Gidding.
No, got me.
Don't say got you. You've got 2 marks for saying bindings. 2 marks to Frank. Well done. Antonia, we're going to call on your considerable scientific knowledge again. Anolia, Thysanura, and Socoptera are extremely unpopular with librarians. Why?
They're pretty unpopular with me, actually. I couldn't imagine myself calling my daughters Anolia, Thysanura.
Some may, yes. A vet might call, a highly specialised sort of book vet might call his daughters those names.
Well, they're obviously things that eat books, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Creepy crawlies. And 3 different kinds of creepy crawlies.
Yes.
A creepy and a crawly.
And a creepy crawly that eats books is well known... at school as...
a bookworm.
Well done. 2 marks to Antonia. So, they are species of bookworms. Dilys, what's the origin of the expression to be in his or her black books?
Oh, that must be one of these historical references which I never know.
It is a historical reference.
It's a historical reference.
The original...
Something with monasteries.
Well, come on, Dilys is doing very well.
Somebody abolished the monasteries.
Yes.
Henry the something.
Yes.
One of the Henrys abolished the monasteries. Yes. Does that help?
That helps, yes.
Didn't help the monasteries.
I don't think I can do any more.
Let's give you a mark and tell you that the original black books were compiled by agents of Henry VIII listing English monasteries which they considered to be sinful. Mm. Dennis, 2 books published this century were entitled Essay on Silence and The Memoirs of an Amnesiac. What do they have in common?
Actually, there was... What was Oscar Levant's autobiography? Wasn't that called Memoirs of an Amnesiac? Something like that.
It's a much more literal...
Is it? Yes. What it looks like is one of those joke... those literary joke. Let me put it this way. Would... in the series, could one include the wit of Michael Heseltine?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Then there are these completely blank books that you can buy.
Exactly. 2 marks to, yeah. to Dennis. Now, before we go on to round 2, here Frank and Dennis are the quotations you were given for the last round. Frank's Twelfth Night, or What You Will, title of a play. Dennis, Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen, a traditional American spiritual. Meanwhile, we're going to inspect some unappetizing slices of male chauvinist pork. Frank, in 1558, a Scot wrote a pamphlet containing the following sentence. I am assured that God hath revealed to some in this our age that it is more than a monster in nature that a woman should reign and bear empire above man. Who was he, and what was the title of the pamphlet?
Och! Yes, it's a Scot who wrote this. And he was, on the whole, anti-feminine.
On the whole?
He was noted for it. And his name is... there were lots of Scots who were...
knock, knock, who's there?
Oh, Dillis, a little fairy writing from... John Knox.
Well done.
John, in which case it's one from mark. The only book I know that he wrote, and 19th century academics said the best thing about the book was its title.
That's right.
Was the first blast of a trumpet against the monstrous regiment of women.
Two marks to Frank.
By one of those coincidences which make being on my word rather happy, I was actually reading that book, believe it or not, and you must believe me, in the British Library. And I came to the sort of appendix, which is when Queen Elizabeth came to the throne. It was written about Mary of Guise in Scotland and Mary Tudor in England, who were both Catholics. When Queen Elizabeth, good Protestant, came to the throne, the letters John Knox had to write explaining that when he said he didn't believe in women ruling, well, he didn't sort of exactly mean that he didn't believe in women ruling. They're so funny.
Well, Antonia, we can't give you a mark for that, but we'll give you a question for a couple of marks. Can you quote the good doctors, Dr. Samuel Johnson's considered view upon women as preachers?
Well, I may not get the words right, but it's been said to me enough for me to get the sense of it right. The wonder was not that it's like the dog playing the violin. The wonder was not that the dog did it well, but that he did it at all. Is that right?
We'll give you two marks. I think you've improved on it. The doctor didn't go as far as the violin. He said, a woman's preaching is like a dog's walking on its hinder legs. It is not done well, but you are surprised to find it done at all. Well done. Dillis.
And he liked women.
Dillis, can you complete the stanza, which begins as follows? O woman, in our hours of ease, uncertain, coy, and hard to please.
Pain and anguish, something or other.
Yes, in pain and anguish, wring the brow.
There's a lady in the audience that watched her.
I can't read them.
Think of nurses.
Yes. A ministering angel thou.
Well done. Two marks for Dillis. There are another couple of lines in the middle, and variable as the shade by the light quivering aspen made, when pain and anguish wring the brow, a ministering angel thou. Sir Walter Scott, Marmion, A Tale of Flodden. There's a doctor I know, he used to always call the nurses thou, because he didn't think they were ministering angels. Send me a thou, he would say. Dennis, in 1748, a father, advising his son on the facts of life, wrote as follows. Women are only children of larger growth. They have an entertaining tattle and sometimes wit. But for solid, reassuring good sense, I never knew in my life one that had it.
Well, father advising his son, 1748, is likely to be that prosy old trout, Lord Chesterfield.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Philip Dormer, Stanhope, 4th Earl of Chesterfield. Now, you get one mark for that.
Oh.
But because our word setter, Peter Moore, is feeling cheeky for the second mark, he wants you to say, would you agree with Lord Chesterfield's evaluation?
with an ardent feminist sitting right on my left, espouse the cause... It would be like preaching against personal hygiene or road safety, you know. Actually, one of the interesting things I read about women not very long ago said that since the invention of elastic, women take up one third less space.
Oh, I think that's worth the second mark. That's worth. I think we'll give you half a bonus mark.
I don't know whether that's delicately anti-feminist or not. I don't know.
No, I don't think so. No.
There was a Frenchman who said that chivalry is the most delicate form of contempt. This is a nice one, isn't it?
We are moving into deep waters. Let us move on. Anyway, you've got your marks, Dennis. Well done. Next round. In the 1880s, the Mrs. Somerville and Ross, who wrote Some Experiences and later Further Experiences of an Irish RM, concocted a private dictionary, as yet unpublished, of invented words with particular meanings. One of their phrase, indeed, was a bosom salad, which meant a vegetable decoration intended to conceal or distract attention from an over-large bust. From the sound of the following words, culled from their dictionary, can you deduce the meaning ascribed to them by these two ladies? And Frank, your word is a doldrumiser. D-O-L-D-R-U-M-I-S-E-R.
Well, doldrums are that sort of lack of wind which becomes ships. No. So it's a doldrumiser is obviously somebody who is so boring that he stops all conversation and stops all movement and thought and just leaves the room absolutely still and calm and deadly.
I will give you two marks for that. I decided to give marks for invention here. Their meaning was a person with a foolish, bemused or stupefied demeanour. Antonio, a grawby in the Somerville and Ross dictionary. What do you think it was? A G-R-A-W-B-Y?
Some kind of rough, woolly dog which comes bounding towards you when you least expect it. When you're out for a walk and a grawby comes and grawls at you. You know at once that the fearful grawby is at your heels. And then it stays with you just long enough for its owner to come and say very indignantly, "Heel, Fido, heel, Fido," as though one was trying to run off with the grawby.
Two marks to Antonio, two marks. A most convincing definition. They use it for a raw, undisciplined child, the scourge of parents and domestics. Not unlike. Dillis. What do they call a Sheba? S-H-E-B-A.
I think a Sheba ought to be an undisciplined woman, not subject to feminist convictions, and rather exasperated by the definitions of women that have just been uttered. Mm. I'm beginning to feel terribly feminist.
A grown-up grawby, in fact. They used it to mean a new possession calculated to excite shameless envy in those to whom it is displayed, deriving from the Queen of Sheba's acute resentment at the sight of King Solomon's furniture.
Furnishings.
Dennis, the word for you is absquatulate. Absquatulate.
Yes, that's not totally unfamiliar. You've heard it. There was a pair of radio comedians called Alexandra Mose, who were actually Billy Bennett and Albert Whelan, and they used to work in blackface, and they used to specialise in using these long words in the wrong way. They used to say, decarbonize yourself, boy, decarbonize yourself. And absquatulate yourself was always, I always took to mean, push off, something like,
Two marks to Dennis and a bonus mark for getting what the definition that they had. Well done.
Well, it's interesting because I think it has more or less made its way into the language, that one. So,
well, it came from Somerville and Ross. They used it as to define an imperative command to small children to be off. B-E off.
Do sit down, isn't it?
Next round. Hyphenated threesomes, composite words such as hide and seek and pitch and toss. What such word can be defined as follows? Frank, haphazardly carefree. A cheerful sort of gambler might help you to get near to it.
Johnny come lately. Cholton come hard. Barry Sandett, no.
Think of a cheerful...
Happy-go-lucky.
Well done. 2 marks to Frank. Antonia, a coronary palpitation. A palpitation. A sort of thing a baker...
Pitter-pat.
Pitter-pat. Well done. 2 marks to Antonia. Dillis, a memorable wayside flower.
Forget-me-not.
Well done. 2 marks to Dillis. Dennis, a maternal mollusk.
I'd written down ring-a-ding.
A maternal mollusk. Don't cast these mollusks before male chauvinist pigs.
Oh, Pearl. Mother of Pearl.
Well done. 2 marks to Dennis. And now we come to Frank's and Dennis's quotations. And Frank's is Twelfth Night or What You Will.
Shakespeare, when he had the idea for a play, could never get started until he got the title, like Twelfth Night or What You Will. And nobody's ever discovered how he got the idea for the title, and I learnt it. I learnt it because I bought this thing from this man I met in the Red Lion in Thorpe, and he was selling things in the bar. He had a cardboard suitcase, and he was selling... second-hand corn plasters, actually. And I said, oh, you sell things, do you? He said, I can get anything for you. Gov, absolutely anything. Now, at that time, I had an ambition to start a literary library. That is, a library of books. And I asked him whether he could get me some old books. He said, anything you like, Gov? And I said, I'd like Johnson's Dictionary, a copy of Johnson's Dictionary... He said, no trouble, Gov. No, week's time. There it was, an ancient Oxford English dictionary, well worn, and inside it said, this book belongs to Johnson. So I paid my £2 with pleasure. I had a Johnson's dictionary at last. So I handed over my couple of quid. And then it was the time when this big thing about Shakespeare was in the air. This chap had discovered a new Shakespeare poem. And also possibly a new Shakespeare play. And I said, now, next I want you to get me Shakespeare. He said, don't know it, Gov. Where is it? Said, Brighton Pier, I know. Clacton Pier. I said, no. He's a writer. He used to write, search for some of his original stuff, anything about him around Stratford. He said, no problem, Gov, no problem. He said, I've got a friend who lives there in Stratford. He said, well, it's more Hackney Marshes. But it's that direction, you know what I mean? I'll get you stuff about Shakespeare. I said, something, perhaps an old diary of Bacon's, anything which will tell me about Shakespeare. Came back a week later. He said, I got it, Gov. And my hands shook like an aspirin. It was this package. He said, it's a manuscript. It's Bacon's diary, all about Shakespeare, whatever his name was. And it was covered in vellum. And it belonged to George Saintsbury, the Victorian literary expert. And it was his copy of Bacon's diary. And I got this parcel wrapped in vellum. Well, it's very thin vellum. It's more like greaseproof paper. And it said on the top in print, it said, Saintsbury's Bacon... And then just knowing the excitement of anybody opening what it said, keep cool. I opened it, and there were these pages. I said, how much? And he said, well, you know, you can't muck around, Gav. He said, 400 years old this is. He said, you won't see much change from a fiver. So I bought it and read it avidly, and there was the truth. It was how Shakespeare thought of this title. Apparently, they were at the Mermaid Tavern. It was a celebration for one of Shakespeare's company who'd danced all the way to Norwich. It was Will Kemp. And they're holding the celebration, and Sir Francis Bacon, as he was there, lifted his glass and said, "I give you a toast. Peasant, listen. To happiness, peasant, or as much as you can get in your lowly life." And Will Kemp leapt to his feet to apply, lifted his glass, without noticing that Will Shakespeare had come in behind him. And Will Kemp then said, thus giving Shakespeare his title, Will Shakespeare, he said, "Sir, to wealth, knight, or what you will."
Thank you for continuing with the bibliophily. Dennis, let's see how you get on with "Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen."
It was one of those rare moments, a lovely summer's evening. I was alone in the garden, and as I looked about me, I had a kind of revelation. This lawn on which I now stand, I thought, purely by my own efforts, I have transformed it from a tangled jungle to a barren desert. And that was literally true. In fact, even to call it a lawn was a gross misuse of the word. All those years of tending it, bending, kneeling, pushing, digging, pulling, lifting, watering, raking, fertilizing, planting, standing over it, saying, "Grow, you swine." And what did I have to show for my efforts? A kind of glorified weed orchard. An arid expanse that looked somewhere between the surface of the moon and a toxic waste dump. To say nothing of the various assortment of physical aches and pains that years of working on it had left me with. When people say that gardening is a painstaking business, I can tell you exactly where the pains take me. Right in the small of the back, there have been summers when that lawnmower pushing has left me walking like Groucho Marx for weeks at a time. And it's no good, those experts, it's no good them telling me that there are ways round that problem, because I have tried them all. "Why not try using a goat to keep your grass down?" they said one week. Well, I can tell you, I did try it. I tried very hard for a long time. There was absolutely no way that I could get that goat to push the mower. What I still can't understand to this day is how it is, if they've managed to invent a self-cleaning oven, why can't somebody invent a self-mowing lawn? And all that doesn't even take into account what the things cost me financially. When I mentally recap some of the items: lawnmower, wheelbarrow, garden hose, spade, rake, mulch, nutrients, peat moss, fertilizer, insect spray, black plastic rubbish bags, sun hat, special manipulative therapy for my back, gallon drums of embrocation, chiropodist fee for the time the mower went over my toes, additional loading of life insurance because of stress symptom. When you tot all those up, it would have worked out cheaper to have the whole area carpeted. So why, in that case, you may ask, why did I persevere with that lawn for so long? Well, because the only thing worse than being an inefficient gardener is having a next-door neighbour who's an absolutely red-hot gardener. You know the kind. He's got a Flymo fitted with a stereo deck. You know. And so dead key, he trims his hedge with a spirit level. Well, I've got one of them. And he shamed me into keeping at it. He'd say things like, "Look at that grass of yours." And I'd say, "Well, don't see much wrong with it. What's wrong with it?" And he said, "Well, nothing that a good brush fire wouldn't cure. And I'd love to know what you intend doing about those weeds." Well, I said, I was thinking of picking out the two tallest ones and slinging a hammock between them. But finally, as I say, came that summer evening when I at last gave up on the whole thing, gazing at the bald patch of brown which marked where my son's paddling pool used to stand. I suddenly thought, here I am, still trying to get the grass to grow back on that spot, and he's now got two children of his own. And that was the point where I decided to, as it were, throw in the trowel. From now on, I decided the lawn can go its own sweet way, and I'll adopt a whole new attitude, a whole new concept about the growing of grass, something along the lines of brown is beautiful. And to any gardening purists who consider that a kind of defeatist attitude, all I'll say is, you have never come across the kind of grass crop that I used to raise, because, if I may tinker with the title of a celebrated spiritual, nobody grows the stubble I've seen.
Thank you, Dennis. Well, while you were throwing in the trowel, we fed the marks into the BBC's gas-fired computer, and it tells us that this week's winners, by a couple of therms, are Antonia and Dennis. So it's a tin each for them of My Word Alphabet Soup, and poor Dillis and Frank will have to make do with the letterless minestrone. And until we all meet again, goodbye.